Let's turn to Luke chapter 17, shall we? In Luke chapter 17, we have a very interesting statement made by the Lord Jesus. In verse 22, it says, He said unto His disciples, The days will come when ye shall desire to see one of the days of the Son of Man, and ye shall not see it. And they shall say to you, See here, or see there, go not after them, nor follow them. For as the lightning that lighteneth out of the one part under heaven shineth unto the other part under heaven, so shall also the Son of Man be in His day. Don't ever let anyone deceive you about coming because Christ is going to come, or going to a certain place, or don't let anyone con you into getting dressed up in white suits and getting up on top of a roof, you know, so you can be ready when He comes. Nonsense. When Christ comes, it's going to happen so quickly that we'll be taken out, just suddenly. No one will have opportunity for preparation. All right, verse 25. But first must He suffer many things and be rejected by this generation. And, of course, this has been accomplished. And then He goes on back to the subject of the time of His coming, and He draws a parallel that is very profound. Notice, as it was in the days of Noah, so shall it also be in the days of the Son of Man. They did eat, they drank, they married wives, they were given in marriage until the day that Noah entered into the ark. And the flood came and destroyed them all. Also, as it was in the days of Lot, they did eat, they drank, they bought, they sold, they planted, they built. Now, isn't that rather interesting that the Lord Jesus picked out two astounding days in world history? The days of Lot and the days of Noah. Now, if I were going to come on the scene and purport to be a world leader, a religious leader, and I wanted people to accept me as credible, you know, I would never mention Noah. Because Noah already had skeptics. Even in that day, there were people far removed that they couldn't buy this story of a big ship being built by one man and the whole world being destroyed by flood and one man floating around on the ark. And if that doesn't get to you, what about the destruction of Sodom and Gomorrah? Why, the world's philosophy is that God is such a benign creature that He would never punish sinners. And the last thing they ever want to think about is that He would bring fire and brimstone on a group of homosexuals. But that's exactly what He did. And Jesus reached into the past. In fact, I have a message that really excites me. I don't know what it did to you when I preached it some years ago, but it really got me fired up. Because of the fact that Jesus reached back from the days of creation and the fall and right down through the Old Testament, and He picked out the hardest things in the world to believe, and He credentialed them. Because every time He referred to them as fact, He put His personal deity on the line in substantiating all of these fantastic events, even to Daniel, the prophet. You know, a lot of people didn't believe that Daniel existed, but Jesus called him a prophet and credentialed the very prophecies that He has given. And He has done that to the days of Noah and the days of Lot. But not only did He certify these, but He did so for a unique purpose. He said, a sign of My coming will be a return in the social environment of the nation, or the people, to the days that precipitated the flood, the days of Noah and the days of Lot. Now, interestingly enough, both of them got so reprehensible in their day that God reached down and He gave a judgment, a cataclysmic, traumatic judgment all at a moment of time. In one case, the story of Lot, it was confined to two cities. They're very nearby. But in the story of Noah, it engulfed the whole world. And in doing so, He gave us a sign and also an evidence. And I'd like to share them both with you tonight. First of all, the sign. And that has to do with the days of Noah and the days of Lot. What kind of days were they? Because if these words mean anything, this is a prophecy that moral conditions and social conditions would parallel the days of His coming with the days of Noah and Lot. All right, now what were they? Four characteristics about them I want you to see. First of all, they were days of sexual perversion. Days of sexual perversion. And I point out that in the outset, that God has always put the act of marriage, which the world erroneously calls sex, on a high, holy, and sacred plane. And there is absolutely no taint of error or evil when it is confined to the sanctity of marriage. Instead, God puts it on the basis of being the most unifying, wholesome and enriching experience two people can share within the confines of marriage. All of the evil involved is outside of that relationship. Now, outside of that relationship, whatever it is, God refers to it as perversion. Whether it's fornication or adultery or homosexuality or sodomaic acts or anything else, it is all perversion when it is outside of that holy relationship for which we were created. Happy is the individual that understands his Creator knows far more about what he needs for the ordinary function in life than he does. And happy is the individual that obeys the principles of his Creator and keeps that relationship in the relationship that he has designed. All right, now, in the days of Noah and the days of Lot, they were moral degenerates. Not only was there a mixture of marriage and a pollution of the race, but you also find that there were homosexuals abounding. I don't have time to get involved in it, but I personally think the sin of Ham was the sin of homosexuality. And this was a carryover from the days of the flood. But we certainly know that homosexuality was abundant on every hand in the days of Lot. As a matter of fact, you read that repugnant story in the 18th chapter of Genesis, and you wonder how depraved people can be until you read the first chapter of the book of Romans, and you find our society described for the most part. And I point out that this mixture of marriage, this mixture of the sexes, and a pollution of the races abounds in our day, and we also have an increase in homosexuality. And I pointed out something a couple of weeks ago. I wonder if you noted it. It bears repeating. In the Bible, the vortex of God's liberty to mankind seems to culminate at homosexuality. When a culture becomes homosexual, it seems that they have filled the dregs of abominations to the full, and then God brings out his unleashed judgment. And I point out to you that we're rapidly approaching such a heinous time in our society. I read in a magazine not too long ago that the Homosexual Society of California boasts 100,000 members and gaining members all the time. As a matter of fact, you have laws passed in Great Britain and also in Canada giving license to these people, legalizing homosexuality. And there is a case right now pending. Somehow they're going to work it on up to the Supreme Court, they think, wherein they're going to challenge the laws of the United States because they think they're being discriminated against. And if you please, the area of discrimination is rather indicative of their depravity. They were refused by some child welfare department in their attempt to adopt children. And so on this basis, they're pursuing their suit. And I wouldn't be a bit surprised but what they win. In this depraved society of ours, we have some sick minds, not only in California, but in Washington, D.C. Doubtless, many of the forms of subversion that go on in the Keynesian school of economics that was started by homosexuals has been perpetuated by the same. And only time will reveal this. But I mention all of this because we are already seeing ample evidence of these very things. Breakdown in marriage. I need not comment on that. It's over the 50% level, and thanks to our present governor, it will increase. If you recall in a recent article in the paper that the first 6 months of the success of the reduction in the divorce laws has increased divorce by 40% already, and it's rising. So by making it 6 months, some people, instead of only getting married 10 times in a given lifetime, they can probably try 15 or 30. And you'll find that it will increase as we have a lessening of the standard of the holiness and the sacredness of this marital institution. So we're parallel in the first, then, are we not, in a sexual perversion. But the second is their imaginations were evil continually. Now, if you've talked to anyone in the world today that is given over to the appetites of the world, you'll find that you're talking to people whose imaginations were evil continually. And I need not remind Californians that this is the pornographic capital of the world. 60% of the pornographic filth that's published in America is produced here in the state of California. When I was in Sacramento just a few weeks ago, Assemblyman E. Richard Barnes reached in his desk drawer and threw out into my lap some of the most filthy, rotten, pornographic literature I've ever seen. He said, "Tim, you know, the biggest problem I have is to make these assemblymen and these senators realize that trash like this is being sold." He said, "I feel like a degenerate having to go in and buy this junk so that I can stick it under their nose and say, this is what's being sold down here in the shops right here in Sacramento. You don't have to go to your own hometown. It's right here in the capital." And he showed me things I could not believe. I mean, there is nothing to the imagination that isn't included in that. And it's all in color now. You know, back when I was exposed to this thing in the service, it was only in black and white. But now it's in living color. Now, what do you think that's going to do to the evil imaginations of the mind? It's going to do what it's always done, feed and feed on it. And you will find that it will multiply and mature until more corruption will be the offshooting. And then if you took time to read in Genesis chapter 6, verse 13, you'll find another characteristic. They were lovers of violence. Violence wrought everywhere in that day, so much so that God interjected in the great flood. And do I have to even take time to give you illustrations of the violence that abounds in our streets? There was a day we didn't have to lock doors. There was a day that we went around with safety. And now, when you contemplate making a decision, our daughter wanted us to send our younger daughter up to Los Angeles on the train. 10 years ago, we probably would have put Lori on the train and had Linda pick her up when she got up to Fullerton and let her go. Now we wouldn't think about it because of the violence that abounds on every hand. Recently, I read of a U.S. senator's wife walking through the park in Washington, D.C., who was stabbed, almost died. The only way that secretaries can get in and out of the congressional office buildings after 5 o'clock is with armed guards. The city of Washington, D.C. is the most dangerous city to be afoot after dark of any city in the whole world. From New York to Los Angeles, we hear report after report of all kinds of violence. And, of course, the communists and the sympathizers of the communists say, well, it's all police brutality. May I suggest that police have probably been more brutalized in the last 5 years than in the last 50 years. It's a dangerous thing to be a policeman. I take my hat off to any, if I wore one, to any policeman for the courage of even volunteering for such difficult service, because he's going to be a walking target for some violent fiend sooner or later. These are tragic, traumatic days in which we live, and it will get worse. But may I point out, this is not unique to America. If it were just America, we could say, well, this is just symptomatic of our decadent society and it will change. But U.S. News and World Report indicated in a lengthy article just recently that this wave of violence we see throughout the United States is a worldwide form of violence. All across South America, various cities are experiencing this wave. Throughout the Orient, Japan has it, Tokyo has it, Calcutta and India have it, and countries in Europe have it. The only places where they don't have it is in communist countries. They have an immediate solution. It's called machine gun bullets. They just solve it very cruelly and arbitrarily, but they don't have freedom there. We have more freedom, but it's a little violent here. Now, the thing that I'm drawing your attention to is that we are living in the same social sphere, in the same social customs. They're days of sexual perversion, days of evil imaginations, and days of violence, and one other similar characteristic. And you'll find that back in our text in Luke, and I'm going to read it to you after I tell you a story. I'm going to interrupt right in the middle of my message and come back to it to tell you a fascinating story. And I'd like to show it to you on the screen. If the men will shut out the lights, I'd like to tell you the story of some of the research regarding the discovery of Noah's Ark. And then we'll get to the fourth one. Now, this is not Noah's Ark. I don't want any of you kids to say you saw a picture of Noah's Ark. This is a Walt Disney drawing of Noah's Ark based on the the subject matter I'm going to give you in just a moment. In fact, could you turn the sound down just a little? In fact, the ark that you see there was drawn by the Disney Foundation that was just about to make all of this into a movie. The story that I'm about to tell came within a hair of being put into a Disney documentary. I hope someday they will. In any case, it's about this area of the world. A mountain called the Mountains, plural of Ararat, that cover 500 square miles. Magnificent mountain that had a strange experience some years ago. Right up here, you notice that flat portion. There's a drawing that dates back to 1829 that shows this peak go up higher right here. And now you find that there's a hole there. Well, in 1840, one-tenth of the mountain in this portion blew out and blew all the way down into this area. And at one time, there was a little city here of 1,000 people buried under dirt now. And you'll find all up and down this valley large boulders that are foreign to the rock formation of the sides, but are the same as the rock formation buried under the ice at the ice cap high above. That ice cap is at its highest point 16,500 feet and comes down to just a little below the 14,500 foot level, depending on the climate and the time of the year. You can see from an airplane view the tremendous tentacles of this ice that comes down into this area, and it descends down into the plain below and it melts off at certain seasons. Now the story indicates that somewhere up here the Ark of Noah came to rest at the end of the flood, and you can imagine that the heat of the water would keep all of this cool. The ark could come to rest very comfortably. The people would get out. And then as the waters receded over who knows how many years' time, then gradually they would migrate down the mountain and ultimately go on out to the uttermost parts of the earth. But this picture will give you an idea of the tremendous thickness of this ice. This is hundreds of feet thick. Remember, you're up in an airplane quite a distance from the spot. And this gives you a view of the overall area. And you wonder, why haven't they found the ark? Can you imagine how long it would take mountain climbers to just investigate this area? And this is minuscule compared to the vast area of ice that is up there. And then notice the thickness of this. Now the ark itself, even though it is a tremendous structure, 3 stories high and as long as an aircraft carrier and as wide, would only be about that size buried within the ice, the size of that light object. And one of the other hazards that you'd be interested in is what happened just a few moments after this picture was taken, they tell me. This man fell right straight through a hole. You see, the ice fills over some of the crevices, and as you walk on them, some fellas weigh a little more than others, and they're just gone. Fortunately, he had a rope tied to his foot and tied to this man and the man up ahead and the man back here. There's a little rope that runs here. And they were able to clamp their feet on the ice and catch him. He only dropped 30 feet. But it scared him. Now, this is another problem. You see the tremendous body of ice that gathers. And you see, one of the things that makes discovering the ark difficult is that there are some decades when it is entirely encased in snow and ice. And then there are some decades that are dry years, no precipitation or very light precipitation up in the mountains, and it's hot below. And so the hot desert winds come up there and it melts off. But then at other times you can't see it at all. So that if you're there 1 year, you may come to the conclusion it's not there, but you're just standing on it. Without knowing it. This is a pack train starting up from the plains below. They come up through this area where there are many goats and sheep. And the Kurdish people are very prominent in that area. These Kurds, by the way, are very interesting. If only we could find out the information locked up in their minds. Their traditions go back to the days of Noah. And many of them have climbed up in this area, but because of their superstitious fear, they will not go above the ice cap. Although some of them have done so, and then they tell stories, but they feel they would be cursed by the gods if they gave out information that would lead to the discovery of the ark. And, of course, they're on hand to sell their goat's milk to the mountain climbers and so on. This picture is about Earl Cummings at the second stage camp. This is the main camp, and supplies are brought up here when they're on a trip. And they go on up into this area, and then they will... I think it's a little different kind of trip than what some of you are thinking of. But it's on a... up here, you'll find at another dry level in this area or in this area, they have their highest camp. And then from here, they go on up into the actual discovery area. Mr. Cummings has been there three times. He was there 2 days last year and chased off by the Turkish government. The Turks would like for us to find Noah's Ark because it would be the archaeological discovery of the world, and it would be the tourist attraction of the world. Pan American Airlines has said that they will build an airstrip there, and the company that built the tramway in Palm Springs has agreed to build a tramway, three-stage tramway up to it, and of course someone else will build motels and hotels up there, maybe Hilton, and someone else has suggested that they would spin a plastic dome to keep over the ark so that it would be forever visible, and it would certainly be a place of interest. However, just on the other side of this hill is a Russian air base, and the Russians do not want anyone to find the ark, obviously, because they're committed to communism, and they very clearly accuse any Americans in that area of being spies of the U.S. State Department and stir up agitation among the Turks. And as you know, in the last few years, they have had more friendly relations with the Turks than the U.S. And so the present political condition is not conducive to discovering the Ark. In 1840, a sleepy village like this one was the recipient of that great blowout that caused the discoveries of Noah's Ark. This is a little drawing from Mr. Parrott's, the archaeologist's drawing book, made in 1829 before the little village was destroyed. And in this little village is this one drawing of a museum. It would be very fascinating to dig down and find some of the relics of that museum. One cannot help but think there must have been some relics of Noah's Ark. In any case, this is the area where the ark has been sighted, up through this gorge. And you see the different material here as found in here. And unfortunately, some of the earlier expeditions in the 30s, or in the 60s, was up here at the top. They just assumed that naturally the ark would be up here at the top. But unfortunately, it wasn't until the last part of 70 or 69 that they came to the conclusion it was down in this area, in reality. And on the basis of the sightings, I'm going to report to you, and putting them all together, you find that it is at the 14,500-foot level. The first sighting after the great explosion of 1840 that we have on record is one of the strangest. It happened that three British atheists went to a little village down below the mountain and asked a man named Hajar Yerim, an Armenian, to guide them up to the top of Mount Ararat, that they wanted to see if Noah's Ark was there. His 10-year-old son was asked to accompany his father, and he took him up the mountain. And lo and behold, to the chagrin of these atheists, they found it. You see, back in England in 1856, there was a strong atheist society that was controlling the whole educational and political structure of the nation. And they wanted to say that they had climbed to the peak of Ararat and they did not see anything of the ark. But unfortunately for their purposes, Mr. Yerim led them to the ark. And they were so incensed, they tried to destroy it, but it is made of petrified wood. And they tried to burn it, but they did not have actual fire implements. And so they threatened the father and the son with the information that if they ever divulge their story, they would come back to kill them. Well, the father lived to be an elderly man and passed away without ever telling his story. But the boy migrated to America. And late in life, when he thought he was going to die, he called a friend in and gave him dictation about this story. The friend took copious notes on the matter and then filed them away, thinking, well, that is an interesting story, but without further confirmation, it really isn't worth much. 2 years after the old man finally died, he picked up a paper, and lo and behold, in that newspaper was the story of one of the three British atheists who on his deathbed confessed that he was a part of that team that went down in 1856 to look for the top of Mount Ararat. And although they had come back to deny ever having seen it, the truth of the matter is they did see it, and he told the same events. Suddenly he realized that he had the story confirmed from two independent sources. This picture is of Sir James Bryce, who later became the ambassador to America, who in 1876 climbed Mount Ararat, and although he did not see the Ark, he found a piece of hand-tooled timber that was obviously very aged. At that time, they had no way of really processing and finding out how old it was, and so he couldn't have it test-dated. The Atheistic Society laughed him to scorn, and not too much was made of his find of wood. Until 1883, a fascinating article appeared in the Chicago Tribune and the New York Times, taken from an article in the London Mail, in which it was reported that some Turkish commissioners had been dispatched by the government up into that area to investigate an avalanche wherein several people had been killed. And lo and behold, when they got there, they found a portion of a large ship protruding from an iceberg, and it had a door in it 20 by 20. They chopped their way into it because it was filled with ice, and they chopped out three rooms, the article said, one of which seemed to be the captain's quarters, wherein a log of events was cut on the wall, which they could not decipher. And outside, they found some pieces of timbers around, which evidently were part of the grating from the inside. Perhaps as a result of that story, Prince Nuri, who was the chief archbishop of the Nestorian Christians, in 1887 climbed the mountain. When he came back, after three attempts, he came back and said that he had seen it, and was awestruck by the dynamic dimensions of this monstrous ship, and that he too had seen three rooms. This picture is about a young white Russian army colonel who I have met personally from Oakland, California now. He migrated after the Russian Revolution and was promoted later to the rank of general. And now he's an elderly man, some 82 years of age, a tremendous linguistic scholar and a brilliant man. But Colonel Coeur substantiates a story that is so amazing. I read this years ago, and then the story was later supposedly discredited, and yet now it has been all but tenaciously confirmed. For example, the story goes like this, that in 1916, the Russian Air Force stationed in Irvan below Mount Ararat received some superchargers for their fighter planes. And so after their installation, a couple of the pilots flew up over Mount Ararat. And as they did so, one of them turned his wing and looked down, and there was what looked to him like a boat lying in a pool of water. And so he flew down closer to it, and sure enough, it was some kind of a ship. And so he went back to his base, and everyone in the squadron laughed at him because it was so ridiculous, except the commanding officer, who had been raised in a Christian family, and he said, "Lieutenant, would you take me up there?" And so he did. And the commanding officer wrote a report, sent it to the Tsar, and the Tsar of all Russia ordered an archaeological expedition sent in two separate parties, 100 men in one and 50 men in another, approaching that area from two different points of view. And they went up there, and the story tells us that they found the Ark, They photographed it, they investigated it, measured it, and wrote a complete report, and a courier was immediately dispatched to the Tsar with all of this information. Unfortunately, the Russian Revolution took place before he got there, and in the first part of 1917, and no one has ever heard of the courier, the photographs, or the measurements since. However, five people have been interviewed by Mr. Cummings who have either been people who claim to be in it, and he interviewed two men who had never met each other, who both told essentially the same story. You see, the problem was they migrated to America, they spoke Russian, and who's going to believe a story like that from a single Russian immigrant? But when you find one in the state of Washington and one in the state of Oregon who have never met, and they both tell the same story, suddenly it becomes a little more intriguing. And then, after that, he met Colonel Kurr, who said that he had talked to several officers in that expedition, that he was doing some study. He was a commander of a post not far from there, and he met several officers who had participated in that expedition and told him essentially the same story. As a matter of fact, he wrote the story in a Russian magazine that was published in New York City, and that's how Mr. Cummings got onto it and traced it to him. And he also met a General Elshin, who was a three-star general in the White Russian Army, who also substantiates the same story. In addition, this fascinating story came out of it. Mr. Cummings, just 6 months ago, found a woman in Mexico whose mother was a favored servant of the Tsar at that time. The woman herself was only 14 years of age, and one day before the communists overthrew the government, the Tsar took several of his trusted servants, told them that the country was in a state of political unrest, and for their safety gave them money and passage out through the Crimean area and told them to flee. And this woman migrated to Mexico. Now, this is the story she tells. She says that just before and she knew nothing about all of the other. All she knew was that Mr. Cummings was looking for evidence about the Ark. She said, well, you know, my mother worked for the Tsar, and she used to come home and tell me that the Tsar's family was all excited about this Air Force man that saw an Ark up in the mountains, and that the Tsar had sent an expeditionary party up there, and every day was waiting for word, but they never heard. So you have this strange story pieced together from many different parts of the world, all telling essentially the same thing. Hopefully, when this book is published, some of the others will come out of hiding and give their substantiation to it also. This man is a Turk. He claims that he wrote a letter to Mr. Cummings in 1946 when it was announced in one of the Turkish papers that he was going to have his first expedition there. Unfortunately, the expedition did not come to pass. But this man wrote him a letter that was kept in the ambassador's headquarters for 20 years. And when Mr. Cummings finally got there in 1966, the U.S. ambassador, a man named Mr. Moore, said, Mr. Cummings, I have a letter here for you that's been here in the files before me. Perhaps you'd like it. And the letter was from this man who said he had interviewed one of five men who, in 1917, returning from the Turkish border back from Damascus, they decided that after the war they would go back home by way of Mount Ararat. And on the way, they came upon Noah's Ark, or at least this large ship. And when he wrote the letter, he said, the man that I have who saw it can guide you to the Ark. But unfortunately, by 1966, when he got the letter, the man was dead. Although there are other people that had heard him tell the story, and they swear that it was true. This is a picture of a former British spy named Hardwick Knight. He's an archaeologist, newspaper writer for Australian newspaper. In any case, Hardwick Knight was coming through Russia and escaping in 1936, and finally had worked his way to the Armenian border, thinking he was safe. He was set upon by some kind of bandits who carried him high up into the mountain area. And then finally, when they had taken all his money and possessions, they set him free, thinking he would die. But he, in his British tenacity, stumbled through the darkness and all of the next day, and finally got to the place where he had seen lights from a certain vantage point and was just barely saved. This man is still living. I have read some of the correspondence between he and Mr. and Mrs. Cummings. And he says that as he was going to safety, he came upon these large blocks, some of them 18 feet long. They were an ancient wood, 9 by 9 and 18 feet in length, very heavy and very dark, and all hand-hewn timbers, high up into the area of Mount Ararat. And he said there were just many of them lying out there in the field. Now, you'll see where that fits into the story later on. Unfortunately, you can't read this letter. It's written by a medical doctor who swears that in 1943, he read an article in the Stars and Stripes newspaper wherein two Air Force pilots flying the route from Tunisia to Ervan in Russia on a lend-lease route for the U.S. government looked down and saw a large ship in what looked like a body of water high up in the mountains of Ararat. And this article has been read by a number of people. We've tried to find it, not been able to locate it. But Chaplain Barnes says he remembers when he was a chaplain in the U.S. Navy, he saw it. And I've had several other people come up to me after lectures and say, well, I remember reading that article. And hopefully we will actually find the article. But this doctor swears he saw it and that two men claim to have seen it from the air. Also, by the way, a Turkish major claims in World War II that he saw it. In 1948, a Turk named Reshet, according to a newspaper article, was up in that area and he claimed he saw it. And when asked whether or not it was really a ship, he said, well, I can tell a ship when I see one. And said that he had tried to cut it with his knife, but that it was so hard. He said it was obviously wood, but it was as hard as brick. Probably, even though frozen, it's a petrified condition. Now, this man is George Jefferson Green, a mining engineer who in 1954 was doing some work for a large oil company in that area. He rented a helicopter and was doing some exploration high up in the mountains of Ararat and saw a large ship protruding from an iceberg. He photographed it, came back to the United States and tried to organize a search party, but he couldn't get anyone to believe him. He had 8 large 8x10 photographs of the Ark, one of which he had taken not more than 90 feet away. And a few years later, after Earl Cummings heard about this man, quite by accident, he went to Corpus Christi, Texas, his hometown, to find him, only to learn that 2 months before, in a mining expedition in British Guiana, he was killed, and no one could find his photographs. However, he has signed statements, names and addresses, and I've seen them, of 30 people in that area who swear they saw George Jefferson Green's photographs of a large ship in Mount Ararat. And this statement, unfortunately, it doesn't come through too clear. Besides, if it did, it's in Turkish, so you wouldn't be able to read it. But this verifies that George Jefferson Green did indeed have permission from the Turkish government for the use of a helicopter in that area. This is a picture of one of the men, a man named Fred Drake, who said, as he remembers looking at those photographs, this is what one of them looked like, that the Ark stuck out from a large iceberg, and then it fell away below. This would make it very difficult to find it in this particular setting. Probably the best known story as a result of a book he wrote is that of Fernand Navarre, the Frenchman, who with his son in 1955 found Noah's Ark. And he has a very good Exhibit A. It's a large chunk of wood. Now, Fernand Navarre was a mountain climber as a young lad, and an Armenian boy, crippled fella, tried to climb mountains with him. Great friendship developed between them. And this boy, one day, as they were lying on a rock in the sun, said, "You know, you have good legs, and I do not. My father told me that Noah's Ark was up in the high reaches of Ararat, and that you ought to find it someday. He wanted me to do it, but I'm not physically able." And he said, "Why don't you do it, Fernand?" And he went back to his home in Paris and ransacked the library there and also in Geneva, Switzerland, and did everything he could in research, and then set out to discover Noah's Ark. He is in the industrial demolition business in Paris, and in his off-season tries to do such things. And in 1955, he and his son went high up into that precarious area, and they saw these dark objects over a cliff. So they lowered their little rope ladder, and he dug down in the ice and found a huge timber. And with his ice axe, he chopped off one portion of that timber. It was a very difficult and painstaking thing, but the timber is 9 by 9 inches, hand-hewn, and 5.5 feet long is this one, which he said he cut off an 18-foot timber. And it accords with the story of Hardwick Knight's timbers and also Sir James Bryce. This timber was... Can't use movies or a slide projection without some kind of malfunction. All right, here's a piece of the wood. It's come down from the original piece of 5 feet because he's given away souvenirs to many people in an attempt to finance further expeditions. And also he has sent pieces of it to different laboratories for testing. And I mentioned to you last week on how the liberals lack objectivity and how they like to say how carbon-14 is so accurate and so on, even though it has been changed many, many times since it first came out in its accuracy. In any case, he sent this to 10 different laboratories. The first two reported that one said it must be 4,500 years old. Another said it was at least 4,285 years old. And then he indicated that he thought it was from Noah's Ark. And suddenly all the reports came in that it was just a few hundred years before Christ. But actually, this piece of wood is a strange anomaly for the skeptic, because this man swears that piece of wood is just one of hundreds of thousands of tons of wood that he saw up there. And since his business background is in that field, he certainly should be accredited some degree of accuracy in estimating how much wood is there. By the way, that wood is so hard that modern-day saws were used, and before they could cut that off square, they broke 3 blades. Now, somewhere up in the high reaches of Ararat, there has been encased for thousands of years Exhibit A that this world was at one time, since the dawn of creation, inundated by a giant flood. And if that comes to light, it will be a phenomenal evidence to those who are of a skeptical frame of mind. Now, I want you to see that little blob there. We have taken this little blob and enlarged it on other photographs many, many times until finally it just got so grainy you couldn't see it. And all photographic experts that have seen it identify that little blob that was photographed from a long ways away through a telephoto lens is a foreign object. And interestingly enough, its proportions are the same as those of Noah's Ark. Now, I'm not saying that the photographer inadvertently photographed Noah's Ark, but it fits in with many of the stories that have already gone before, and either that or something like that is going to finally come to light and once and for all give the world the evidence that Noah's Ark did indeed exist, and it has indeed been preserved by God for all these centuries. And now I'd like to sum up where I left off before I started showing you the films, just in a moment, and then draw a conclusion. In addition to the evidence that we've presented, I submit the statement of the Lord Jesus and this rather interesting thought. He said, as it was in the days of Noah, so shall it be in the days of the coming of the Son of Man. We've already examined the three characteristics. Now I want you to see the fourth characteristic. He says, in addition, they did eat, they drank, they married wives, they were given in marriage until the day that Noah entered into the ark, and the flood came and destroyed them all. Now, think with me on this carefully. What's wrong with marrying and giving in marriage? What's wrong with eating and drinking? What's wrong with giving and, or buying and selling? Nothing. Unless you're standing on the brink of catastrophe. Unless at the point in time when the preacher of God's message is condemning the society and saying, repent, because judgment is about to fall, you pay no heed. That's the sin of Noah's day. And may I suggest that's the sin of our day. With all kinds of evidence on every hand to indicate that the coming of the Lord draweth nigh, people run their own way through life independent of God, caring not for their relationship to God, not heeding the message and the call of God. That's the sin of Noah's day, and it's the sin of our day. As Fernand Navarra said, and I'd like to close with this thought. He said, if that isn't Noah's Ark, 14,500 feet in altitude, wedged in between ice and rock, 150 miles from the nearest tree, what else could it be? Yes, what else could it be? Only a gigantic force of water could float that object up to that tremendous altitude. Yes, there's strong indication that Noah's Ark exists. In fact, I wouldn't be a bit surprised if one of these days you open the paper, and there it is, pictured for us in our daily paper. It will change the whole spectrum of philosophy. But may I suggest we don't have to wait for that final revelation. It may not come until after the Lord Jesus comes. Or it may not come at all. There's nothing that indicates it has to. I wouldn't be surprised because I know that God is a revealer of himself, and certainly it would reveal the authenticity of the Word. However, may I suggest we do not need to wait until that day to have sufficient evidence to believe in the personal deity of Jesus Christ. And I would like to ask you this very personal question. Have you come to that place in your life where you have said, yes, I believe that Jesus Christ is the Son of God and that I am prepared to meet Him? Because more important than the ark, more important than Noah, is whether or not you and I are ready when Christ calls. We're living in the days of Noah. Are you ready? If He came right now, would He find you waiting, watching, anticipating His coming? Let's bow together, shall we, for a word of prayer.